I'm wearing grown-up pants. Shirtless, barefoot, pale round belly like an old man's. Then the little cuffed shirt and buttoning it up. Goodbye, little belly. We are enshirting you now. Enshirting? I do not believe that is even a word, father. I tied the little tie, spun him around for a look. We have dressed up a wild savage, looks like, I said. He made the growling face. His hair stuck straight up, his cheeks were red. Racing around that store just previous, he had knocked over a rack of socks. The tailor, complicit, brought out the little jacket with much pomp. Then the shy, boyish smile as I slid the jacket on him. "Say," he said, "don't I look fine, father?" Then no thought at all for a while, and we just looked about us. Bare trees, black against the dark blue sky. Little jacket, little jacket, little jacket. This phrase sounded in our head. A star flickered off, then on. Same one he is wearing back in there now. Huh. Same little jacket. But he who is wearing it is... I so want it not to be true. Broken. Pale, broken thing. Why will it not work? What magic word made it work? Who is the keeper of that word? What did it profit him to switch this one off? What a contraption it is. How did it ever run? What spark ran it? Grand little machine. Set up just so, receiving the spark, it jumped to life. What put out that spark? What a sin it would be. Who would dare? Ruin such a marvel. Hence is murder anathema. God forbid I should ever commit such a grievous...
Something then troubling us.
We ran one hand roughly over our face, as if attempting to suppress a notion just arising.
This effort not proving successful.
The notion washed over us.
47.
Young Willie Lincoln was laid to rest on the day that the casualty lists from the Union victory at Fort Donelson were publicly posted. An event that caused a great shock among the public at that time, the cost in life being unprecedented thus far in the war.
In Setting the Record Straight, Memoir, Error, and Evasion by Jason Tum, Journal of American History.
The details of the losses were communicated to the president even as young Willie lay under embalmment.
Iverness, Opsit.
More than 1,000 troops on both sides were killed, and three times that number wounded. It was a most bloody fight, a young Union soldier told his father. So devastating to his company that despite the victory, he remained sad, lonely, and downhearted. Only 7 of the 85 men in his unit survived.
Goodwin, Opsit.
The dead at Donelson, sweet Jesus, heaped and piled like threshed wheat, one on top of two, on top of three. I walk through it after with a bad feeling. Lord, it was me done that, I thought.
In These Battle Memories by First Lieutenant Daniel Brower.
1,000 dead. That was something new. It seemed a real war now.
In The Great War as Described by Its Warriors by Marshall Turnbull.
The dead lay as they had fallen, in every conceivable shape. Some grasping their guns as though they were in the act of firing, while others, with a cartridge in their icy grasp, were in the act of loading. Some of the countenances wore a peaceful, glad smile, while on others rested a fiendish look of hate. It looked as though each countenance was the exact counterpart of the thoughts that were passing through the mind when the death messenger laid them low. Perhaps that noble-looking youth with his smiling, upturned face, with his glossy ringlets matted with his own lifeblood, felt a mother's prayer stealing over his senses as his young life went out. Near him lay a young husband with a prayer for his wife and little one yet lingering on his lips. Youth and age, virtue and evil, were represented on those ghastly countenances. Before us lay the charred and blackened remains of some who had been burnt alive. They were wounded too badly to move, and the fierce elements consumed them.
In The Civil War Years, a Day-by-Day Chronicle of the Life of a Nation, edited by Robert E. Denny, account of Corporal Lucius W. Barber, Company D, 15th Illinois Volunteer Infantry, combatant at Fort Donelson.
I had never seen a dead person before. Now I saw my fill. One poor lad had frozen solid in the posture of looking down aghast at his wound, eyes open. Some of his insides had spilled out and made, there on his side, under a thin coat of ice, a blur of purple and red. At home on my dressing table was a holy card of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and this fellow looked like that. Only his bulge of red and purple was lower and larger, and off to one side, and him gazing down at it in horror.
In That Terrible Glory, a collection of Civil War letters from the men who fought it, compiled and edited by Brian Bell and Libby Trust.
And Mother Fire had swept through the frozen dead and hurt where they lay. We found one still kicking among them and was able to bring him back still alive, not even knowing which side he was on. So burned was he, and naked except for one leg of his pants. I never did hear how he made out, but it did not look hopeful for that poor devil.
In Letters of an Illinois Soldier, edited by Sam Westfall, account of Private Edward Gates, Company F, 15th Illinois Volunteer Infantry.
Two or three of us would grab a fellow and haul him away just as we found him, as it was cold and the bodies were completely froze. That day I learned a person can get used to anything. Soon it all seemed normal to us, and we even joked about it, making up names for each, depending on how it looked. There was bent over, there was shocked, this was half boy.
Brower, upset.
We found two little fellers holding hands, couldn't have been more than 14, 15 apiece, as if they had decided to pass through that dark portal together.
Gates, upset.
How many more dead do you attend to make, sir, afore you is done? One minute, there was our little Nate on that bridge with a fish pole, and where is that boy now? And who is it called him hither in that notice he saw down to Orbeez? Well, sir, that was your name he saw upon it, Abraham Lincoln.
In Country Letters to President Lincoln, compiled and edited by Josephine Banner and Evelyn Dressman. Letter from Robert Hansworthy, Boonesboro, Maryland. '48.
He is just one, and the weight of it about to kill me. Have exported this grief some 3,000 times so far to date. A mountain of boys, someone's boys, must keep on with it. May not have the heart for it. One thing to pull the lever when blind to the result, but here lies one dear example of what I accomplish by the orders I may not have the heart for it. What to do? Call a halt? Toss down the loss hole, those 3,000? Sue for peace? Become great course-reversing fool? King of indecision? Laughing stock for the ages, waffling hick, slim Mr. Turnabout? It is out of control. Who is doing it? Who caused it? whose arrival on the scene began it. What am I doing? What am I doing here? Everything nonsense now. Those mourners came up, hands extended, sons intact, wearing on their faces enforced sadness masks to hide any sign of their happiness, which went on. They could not hide how alive they yet were with it, with their happiness at the potential of their still living sons. Until lately I was one of them, strolling, whistling through the slaughterhouse, averting my eyes from the carnage, able to laugh and dream and hope, because it had not yet happened to me. To us. Trap. Horrible trap. At one's birth it is sprung. Some last day must arrive, when you will need to get out of this body, bad enough. Then we bring a baby here. The terms of the trap are compounded. That baby also must depart. All pleasures should be tainted by that knowledge. But hopeful, dear us, we forget. Lord, what is this? All of this walking about, trying, smiling, bowing, joking. This sitting down at table, pressing of shirts, tying of ties, shining of shoes, planning of trips, singing of songs in the bath. When he is to be left out here, is a person to nod, dance, reason, walk, discuss? As before. A parade passes. He can't rise and join. Am I to run after it, take my place, lift knees high, wave a flag, blow a horn? Was he dear or not? Then let me be happy no more.
49.
It was quite cold. Being in the gentleman, we were, for the first time in...
ever so long.
Quite cold ourselves.
He sat distraught and shivering, seeking about for any consolation. He must either be in a happy place or some null place by now, thought the gentleman. In either case, his... no longer suffering, suffered so terribly at the end. The racking cough, the trembling, the vomiting, the pathetic attempts to keep the mouth wiped with a shaky hand, the way his panicked eyes would steal up and catch mine as if to say, "Is there really nothing, Papa, you can do?" And in his mind the gentleman stood, we stood with him, on a lonely plain, screaming at the top of our lungs. Quiet then, in a great weariness. All over now. He is either in joy or nothingness. So why grieve? The worst of it for him is over. Because I loved him so, and am in the habit of loving him, and that love must take the form of fussing and worry and doing. Only there is nothing left to do. Free myself of this darkness as I can. Remain useful, not go mad. Think of him, when I do, as being in some bright place, free of suffering, resplendent in a new mode of being. Thus thought the gentleman, thoughtfully combing a patch of grass with his hand.
50.
Sad.
Very sad.
Especially given what we knew.
His boy was not in some bright place, free of suffering.
No.
Not resplendent in a new mode of being.
au contraire.
Above us, an errant breeze loosened many storm-broken branches.
Which fell to the earth at various distances.
As if the woods were full of newly roused creatures.
I wonder, said Mr. Volman, and I knew what was coming.
51.
We wished the lad to go, and thereby save himself. His father wished him to be in some bright place, free of suffering, resplendent in a new mode of being. A happy confluence of wishes. It seemed we must persuade the gentleman to return with us to the Whitestone home. Once there, we must encourage the lad into the gentleman, hoping that, while therein, having overheard his father's wish, he would be convinced to—
A fine idea, I said, but we have no method by which to accomplish it.
There has historically been some confusion around this issue.
No confusion at all, friend. It is simply not within our power to communicate with those of that ilk, much less persuade them to do anything. And I think you know it.
52.
I beg to differ. We caused a wedding once, if you will recall.
Highly debatable.
A couple strolling here on the brink of ending their engagement reversed their decision under our influence.
Almost certainly a coincidence.
Several of us, Hightower, the three of us, and what was his name, the decapitated fellow?
Ellers.
Ellers, of course. Bored, we swarmed and entered that couple, and, through the combined force of our concentrated wishfulness, were able to effect—
This much is true. They were overcome with sudden passion and retreated behind one of the stone homes.
To act upon said passion.
While we watched.
I have misgivings about that. The watching.
Well, you had no misgivings on that day, my dear fellow. Your member was swollen to an astonishing size. And even on a normal day, it is swollen to—
I seem to remember you watching as well. I do not recall the slightest aversion of any of your many, many—
Truly, it was invigorating to see such passion. The fury of their embraces was remarkable.
Yes. They sent birds winging from the trees with their terrific moans of pleasure.
After which they renewed their commitment and departed, hand in hand, reconciled, betrothed again.
And we had done it.
Come now, they were young, lustful, alone in an isolated spot on a beautiful spring night. They hardly needed any help from—
Friend, we are here. Already here. Within. A train approaches a wall at a fatal rate of speed. You hold a switch in your hand that accomplishes you know not what. Do you throw it? Disaster is otherwise assured. It costs you nothing. Why not try?
53.
There in the gentleman, Mr. Bevins reached for my hand.
And we began.
To persuade the gentleman.
To attempt to persuade him.
Together, the two of us began to think of the Whitestone home.
Of the boy.
His face, his hair, his voice.
His gray suit.
Turned-in feet.
Scuffed shoes.
Stand up. Go back, we thought as one. Your boy requires your counsel.
He is in grave danger.
It is anathema for children to tarry here.
His headstrong nature, a virtue in that previous place, imperils him here, where the natural law, harsh and arbitrary, brooks no rebellion, and must be scrupulously obeyed.
We request, therefore, that you rise.
And return with us to save your boy.
It did not seem to be working.
The gentleman just sat, combing the grass, rather blank-minded.
It seemed we must be more direct.
We turned our minds by mutual assent to a certain shared memory of Miss Traynor.
Christmas last, paying a holiday visit, we found that, under the peculiar strain of that blessed holiday, she had gone beyond the fallen bridge. The vulture, the large dog, the terrible hag gorging on black cake, the stand of flood-ravaged corn, the umbrella ripped open by a wind we could not feel.
And was manifesting as an ancient convent containing 15 bitter, quarreling nuns about to burn to the ground.
A girl-sized convent in the style of a Greda, the little nuns inside her just embarking on morning vespers.
Suddenly the place, the girl, is ablaze, screams, shrieks, grunts, vows renounced, if only one might be saved.
But none are saved. All are lost.
We willed ourselves to see it again, smell it again, hear it again. The incense, the fragrant wall-lining sage bushes, the rose-scented breeze wafting down from the hill, the shrill nun screams, the padding of the tiny nun feet against the packed red clay of the town-bound trail.
Nothing.
He just sat.
Now, together, we became aware of something.
In his left trouser pocket.
A lock.
The lock from the white stone home.
Heavy and cold. Key still in it.
He had forgotten to rehang it.
An opportunity to simplify our argument.
We focused our attention upon the lock.
Upon the perils of an unlocked door.
I called to mind Fred Downs, raging in frustration as those drunken anatomy students tossed his bag sick form onto their cart, horses rearing with alarm at the smell.
I pictured the wolf-rended torso of Mrs. Scoville, tilted against her doorframe, one arm torn away, little veil fluttering in what remained of her white hair. Imagined the wolves massing in the woods even now, sniffing the breeze, making for the white stone home, snarling, drooling, bursting in, etc.
The gentleman put his hand into that pocket.
Closed it upon the lock.
Shook his head unhappily. How could I have forgotten such a simple...
Got to his feet.
And walked off.
In the direction of the white stone home.
Leaving Mr. Volman and me there, behind him on the ground.
54.
Had we done it?
It seemed that perhaps we had.
55.
Because we were as yet intermingled with one another, traces of Mr. Volman naturally began arising in my mind, and traces of me naturally began arising in his.
Never having found ourselves in that configuration before...
This effect was an astonishment.
I saw, as if for the first time, the great beauty of the things of this world. Water drops in the woods around us plopped from leaf to ground. The stars were low, blue-white, tentative. The wind scent bore traces of fire, dryweed, river muck. The tisking dry-bush rattles swelled with a peaking breeze as some distant cross-creek sleigh-nag tossed its neck-bells.
I saw his Anna's face and understood his reluctance to leave her behind.
I desired the man-smell and the strong hold of a man.
I knew the printing press loved operating it. New platen, roller hook, gripper bar, chase bed. Recalled my disbelief as a familiar center beam came down, that fading, final, panicked instant. I have crashed through my desk with my chin. Someone, Mr. Pitts, screams from the anteroom. My bust of Washington lies about me, shattered.
The stove ticks. In my thrashing panic, I have upended a chair. The blood, channeled within the floorboard interstices, pools against the margins of the next room rug. I may yet be revived. Who has not made a mistake? The world is kind, it forgives, it is full of second chances. When I broke Mother's vase, I was allowed to sweep the fruit cellar. When I spoke unkindly to Sophia, our maid, I wrote her a letter, and all was well.
As soon as tomorrow, if I can only recover, I will have her. I will sell the shop, we will travel. In many new cities I will see her in dresses of many colors, which will drop to many floors. Friends already, we will become much more. We'll work every day to expand the frontiers of our happiness, as she once so beautifully put it. And there may be children yet. I am not so old, only 46, and she is in the prime of her...
Why had we not done this before?
So many years I had known this fellow, and yet had never really known him at all.
It was intensely pleasurable.
But was not helping.
The gentleman was gone, headed back to the Whitestone home.
Impelled by us.
Oh, wonderful night!
I exited Mr. Volman.
Upon Mr. Bevan's exit, I was immediately filled with longing for him and his associated phenomena, a longing that rivaled the longing I had felt for my parents when I first left their home for my apprenticeship in Baltimore, a considerable longing indeed. Such had been the intensity of our cohabitation. I would never fail to fully see him again. Dear Mr. Bevins.
Dear Mr. Volman. I looked at him. He looked at me.
We would be infused with some trace of one another forevermore.
But that was not all.
We seemed now to know the gentleman as well.
Removed from both Volman and the gentleman, I felt arising within me a body of startling new knowledge. The gentleman was Mr. Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln was president. How could it be? How could it not be? And yet I knew with all my heart that Mr. Taylor was president.
That Mr. Polk occupied that esteemed office.
And yet I knew with all my heart that Mr. Lincoln was president. We were at war. We were not at war. All was chaos. All was calm. A device had been invented for distant communication. No such device existed, nor ever could. The notion was mad. And yet I had seen it, had used it, could hear in my mind the sound it made as it functioned. It was telegraph. My God!
On the day of the beam, Polk had been president. But now I knew, with a dazzling clarity, that Polk had been succeeded by Taylor, and Taylor by Fillmore, and Fillmore by Pierce.
After which Pierce had been succeeded by Buchanan, and Buchanan by...
Lincoln.
President Lincoln.
The rail line ran beyond Buffalo now.
Far beyond.
The Duke of York nightcap is no longer worn. There is something called the slashed Pamela sleeve.
The theaters are lit now with gaslight, strip lights, and ground rows being employed in this process.
The resulting spectacle is a wonder.
Has revolutionized the theater.
The facial expressions of the actors are seen most clearly.
Allowing for an entirely new level of realism in the performance.
It would be difficult to express the perplexity these revelations thrust upon us.
We turned and ran, skimmed back toward the Whitestone home, talking most excitedly.
Mr. Bevan's hair and numerous eyes, hands, and noses, velocity streaming behind him.
Mr. Volman bearing his tremendous member in his hand so as not to trip himself on it.
Soon we were in Mr. Lincoln's lee, so close we could smell him.
Soap, pomade, pork, coffee, smoke.
Milk. Incense. Leather.
Book 2. 56.
The night of February 25th, 1862, was cold but clear, a welcome respite from the terrible weather the capital city had been experiencing. Willie Lincoln was now interred, and all ceremonial activities associated with that activity concluded. The nation held its breath, hopeful the president could confidently reassume the wheel of the ship of state in this, its hour of greatest need.
In The Spiritual Lincoln, An Essential Journey by C.R. DePage. 57.
By 2 a.m. the president had not yet returned to the White House. I considered waking Mrs. Lincoln, although it was not unusual for the president to ride out alone evenings. He would routinely refuse any escort. Tonight he had ridden Little Jack, of whom he was fond. The night was cold and wet. He had not taken his greatcoat, which still hung on the peg. He would be chilled when he returned, that much was certain, although his constitution was strong. I took up my post near the door, now and then stepping out to listen for Little Jack's trod. Another half hour passed, and still no Mr. Lincoln. If I were in his shoes, I thought, I might keep riding, and never come back, until I had ridden myself back west into a life of less import and trouble. When 3 a.m. had come and gone, I began to think he might have done just that. I again considered waking Mrs. Lincoln, but pity forbade me. She was in a very poor state. I found it strange that he should have left her alone at such a time. But she was heavily sedated and, I think, not aware that he was gone.
Hilliard opposite, account of Paul Riles, White House Guard. 58.
Mary Lincoln's mental health had never been good, and the loss of young Willie ended her life as a functional wife and mother.
In A Mother's Trial, Mary Lincoln and the Civil War by Jane Coster.
Around 2 in the afternoon, I heard a terrible commotion from the part of the house where the sick child lay. It appeared the moment had come. Mrs. Lincoln rushed past me, head lowered, making a sound I have never heard emitted from human throat, before or since.
Hilliard opposite, account of Sophie Lennox made.
While the president's outburst allowed for depiction, his wife's did not.
Epstein opposite.
The pale face of her dead boy threw her into convulsions.
Keckley opposite.
Mary Lincoln collapsed into her bed.
Von Drayley, opposite.
An altered woman.
Keckley, opposite.
Laudanum being administered, even this powerful concoction could not suppress her cries of agony or subdue her disbelieving outrage.
Coster, opposite.
Mrs. Lincoln was too ill to attend the funeral services.
Leach opposite.
Mary Lincoln stayed abed for a full 10 days following the funeral.
In A Bell Remade, The Journey of Mary Lincoln by Kevin Swarney.
Mrs. Lincoln was unable to leave her room or rise from bed for many weeks after the tragedy.
Sloan opposite.
When she finally emerged a month later, she moved about mechanically, gazing at us as if we were strangers.
Hilliard opposite, account of D. Strumport Butler.
Some blows fall too heavy upon those too fragile.
Coster opposite.
There she lay, longing that the thing should not be so, now disbelieving that it had occurred, now convinced anew that it had. Always the same walls. Bed things, cup, ceiling, windows. She could not rise and leave, the world outside too terrible now. She sipped of the drugged drink that was her only hope for peace.
Swarney opposite.
Where was her boy? She kept asking. Where was he? Couldn't someone find him, bring him to her at once? Mustn't he yet be somewhere?
Hilliard opposite, account of Sophie Lennox made. '59.
All so quiet, dear brother. Only the fire popping and dear Grace snoring from your old room, where I have put her, so she may more easily attend me on these difficult nights. The moonlight shows the premises across the way littered far and wide with the detritus of yesterday's great storm. Mighty tree limbs lay against crypts and across graves, You may recall a certain statue of a bald man in Roman garb, whom we used to call Morty, standing with one foot on the neck of a snake, and that once a certain mischievous young fellow threw his sweater up there many times until Morty might catch it upon the end of his sword. Well, Morty is no more, or at least is not the man he once was. A falling limb hit that brave Roman at the arm, and off it came, sword and all, taking off the head of the snake on its way down. Now arm and sword and snake head lie in a heap, and Morty himself, as if shaken by this proof of his immortality, stands a bit askew on his base. Must have dozed a bit just now. Yes, it is nearly 4. There is a horse over there, across the way, tied to the cemetery fence. A calm and exhausted fellow, nodding as if to say, "Well, though I find myself at the yard of the dead in the dark of night, I am hoarse and must obey." So now I have a mystery to distract me. Who could be over there at such a late hour? Some young gentleman, I hope, paying homage to a true love lost. The light burns in Mander's little guardhouse, and he paces back and forth before the window, as is his habit. You may recall that it was he who mounted a ladder to retrieve the aforementioned sweater from Morty's sword. He is older now and looks it, burdened, I think, with many family concerns, and now leaves the guardhouse, his lantern light receding. He is seeking, I imagine, our midnight visitor. All very intriguing. Whoever might think that an impairment such as mine disallows excitement? I wish that individual could sit here beside me at this window tonight. I will stay awake, I think, and see if I may glimpse the face of our visitor once Manders retrieves the fellow.
60.
Left behind on the roof of the Whitestone home, I resolved to make one final attempt to talk sense to the boy, who lay nearly insensate at my feet like a dazed and fallen Pasha prince. My feelings had been hurt by the juvenile, deceptive actions of Mr. Bevins and Mr. Volman, who, in their rush to chase after the slightest amusement, had left me in a very bad position indeed. Like some sort of primitive gardener, I worked, bent at the waist, seizing at tendrils with both hands. I must continually be deciding whether to attack the several already attached or take on their new arising brethren. In truth, it mattered not what I did. The boy's time was not long. An opportunity soon presented for a frank moment with him. Scanning the horizon for the feckless Bevins and Volman, I saw instead, creeping out of the woods, the Crutcher brothers, accompanied as usual by Mr. and Mrs. Reedy, the four of them comprising the core group of that depraved, orgiastic cohort that resided near the flagpole. "We come to watch," said Matt Crutcher. "The decline," said Richard Crutcher. "It is of interest to us," said Mrs. Reedy. "We watched it last time," said Matt Crutcher, "with that gal." "Found it most stimulating," said Mr. Reedy. "Really gave us a boost," said Mrs. Reedy. "And everyone needs a boost," said Mr. Reedy. "In this dunghole," said Matt Crutcher. "Don't judge us," said Mr. Reedy. "Or do," said Mrs. Reedy. "Makes us feel naughtier," said Matt Crutcher. "To each their own," said Richard Crutcher, stepping over close to Mrs. Reedy. "Perhaps," said Mrs. Reedy, slipping her hand into his pants pocket. The group now fell into a watchful, rapacious squat, disgusting vultures, drawn here by the boy's misfortune, and soon got up to some strange, cross-handed business, manifesting as one terrible creature, their pumping arms and rhythmic gasping conveying a distinctly mechanical impression. "What do you think?" I said to the boy. "Is this a good place? A healthy place? Do these people seem sane to you and worthy of emulation?" "And yet, here you are," the boy said. "I am different," I said. "From me?" he said. "From everyone," I said. "Different how?" he said, and I teetered on the brink of telling him.
61.
For I am different, yes. Unlike these, Bevins, Volman, the dozens of other naifs I reside here among, I know very well what I am. Am not sick, not lying on a kitchen floor, not being healed via sick box, not waiting to be revived. No. Even there at the end, in our guest room, with the view of the bricks of the Rednell house next door, upon which there hung a flowering vine, it was early June. The stable and grateful state of mind I had tried to cultivate all my life, via my ministry, left me in a state of acceptance and obedience, and I knew very well what I was. I was dead. I felt the urge to go. I went. Yes. Simultaneously becoming cause and awed observer from within of the bone-chilling fire sound associated with the madder-like blooming phenomenon, an experience I shall not even attempt to describe, I went and found myself walking along a high mountain trail, preceded by two men who, I understood, had passed only seconds before. One wore a funeral suit of a very cheap type and looked this way and that like a tourist and was rather oddly humming in a way that communicated a sense of vacuous happiness, willful ignorance. Though he was dead, his attitude seemed to be, "Ha-ha, what's all this then?" The other wore a yellow bathing costume, had a beard of flaming red, moved along angrily as if in a hurry to get somewhere he very much resented going. The former man was from Pennsylvania, the latter from Maine, Bangor or thereabouts. Had spent much time in farm fields and often made his way to the coast to sit for hours on the rocks. He wore a bathing costume because he had drowned while swimming. Somehow I knew this. Periodically, as I made my way down that trail, I was also back here, was in my grave, was startled out of my grave by the sight of what lay in my coffin. That prim-looking, dry-faced relic was above my grave, nervously walk-skimming about it. My wife and congregation were saying their final goodbyes, their weeping driving small green daggers into me, literal daggers. With each sob, a dagger left the griever and found its way into me, most painfully. Then I was back there, upon that trail with my two friends. Below us lay a distant valley that I somehow knew to be our destination. A set of stone steps became visible. My companions paused, glanced back. Recognizing me as a man of God, I had been buried in my vestments, they seemed to be asking, should we proceed? I indicated that we should. From the valley below, chanting of some sort, excited voices, the clanging of a bell. These sounds contented me. We had journeyed, had arrived. The festivities might now begin. I was filled with happiness that my life had been judged worthy of such a spectacular denouement. Then vexingly, I was back here, my wife and congregation now departing in coaches, occasionally sending forth the random green dagger, the impact of which did not lessen no matter how far they drove. Soon my mourners had crossed the Potomac and were eating the funeral meal at Previe's. I knew this even as I paced back and forth before my grave. I became panicked at the prospect of becoming stranded here, wished only to rejoin my friends there, on that stairway. This place was now entirely unappealing, a boneyard, a charnel ground, a garbage dump, a sad remnant of a discouraging and grossly material nightmare from which I was only just waking. Instantaneously, with that very thought, I was there again, with my friends, coming off those stairs into a sun-drenched meadow in which stood a large structure unlike any I had ever seen, built of interlocking planks and wedges of purest diamond, giving off an array of colors that changed of the instant with any slight variation in the quality of the sunshine. We approached arm in arm. A crowd gathered about us, ushering us along. An honor guard stood by the door, beaming at our approach. The door flew open. Inside, a vast expanse of diamond floor led to a single diamond table, at which sat a man I knew to be a prince, not Christ, but Christ's direct emissary. The room was reminiscent of Hartley's warehouse, the place I had known as a boy. A tremendous open space, high-ceilinged and forbidding, made more forbidding by the presence of an authority figure, Hartley himself in those early days, that Christ emissary now, seated near a source of heat and light, a fireplace then, a jagged topaz now, on fire from within, upon a stand of pure gold. We understood that we were to step forth in our previous order. Our red-bearded friend, ridiculous in his bathing costume, went first. Appearing now from either side, walking in perfect step with him as he approached the table, were two beings, beautiful in appearance, tall, thin, luminous, borne on feet of sun-yellow light. "How did you live?" one asked. "Tell it truthfully," the other said, as from either side they gently touched their heads to his. Both beamed with pleasure at what they found within. "May we confirm?" said the one on the right. "Sure," said our red-bearded friend, "and I hope you will, too." The yellow-footed being on the right sang out a single joyful note, and several smaller versions of himself danced out. I use this word to denote the utter grace of their movements, bearing a large mirror, the edges of which were encrusted with precious gems. The yellow-footed being on the left sang his single joyful note, and several smaller versions of himself tumbled out, rolling forth in the most exquisite sequence of gymnastic movements imaginable, bearing a scale. "Quick check," said Christ's emissary from his seat at the diamond table. The being on the right held the mirror up before the red-bearded fellow. The being on the left reached into the red-bearded man's chest, and with a deft and somehow apologetic movement, extracted the man's heart and placed it on the scale. The being on the right checked the mirror. The being on the left checked the scale. "Very good," said the Christ emissary. "We are so happy for you," said the being on the right, and I cannot adequately describe the sound of rejoicing that echoed then from across what I now understood to be a vast kingdom extending in all directions around the palace. A tremendous set of diamond doors at the far end of the hall flew open, revealing an even vaster hall. I perceived, there within, a tent of purest white silk, although to describe it thus is to defame it. This was no earthly silk, but a higher, more perfect variety, of which our silk is a laughable imitation, within which a great feast was about to unfold, and on a raised dais sat our host, a magnificent king, and next to the king's place sat an empty chair, a grand chair, upholstered with gold, if gold were spun of light, and each particle of that light exuded joy and the sound of joy, and that chair was intended, I understood, for our red-bearded friend. Christ was that king within. Christ was also, I now saw, that seated prince emissary at the table, in disguise or secondary emanation. I cannot explain it. The red-bearded man passed through the diamond doors in his characteristic rolling gait, and the doors closed behind him. Never in my nearly 80 years of life on earth had I experienced a greater or more bitter contrast between happiness, the happiness I felt even glimpsing that exalted tent from such a great distance, and sadness. I was not within the tent, and even a few seconds without seemed a dreadful eternity. I began to weep, as did my funeral-suited friend from Pennsylvania. But his weeping, at least, was leavened with anticipation, for he was next. his separation from that place to be that much briefer than mine. He stepped forward. "How did you live?" asked the being on the right. "Tell it truthfully," the other said as, from either side, they gently touched their heads to his. They recoiled, then withdrew to two gray stone pots set down on either side of that grand hall, into which they vomited twin streams of brightly colored fluid. The small versions of themselves rushed to bring towels, upon which they wiped their mouths. "May we confirm?" said the one on the right. "Wait, what did you see?" he said. "Is there some..." But it was too late. The being on the right sang a single ominous note, and out came the several smaller versions of himself, but crippled and grimacing, bearing between them a feces-encrusted mirror. The being on the left sang his somber, jarring note, and several smaller versions of himself tumbled out, rolling forth via a series of spastic, clumsy gymnastic movements that were somehow accusatory, bearing the scale. "Quick check," the Christ Prince said sternly. "I'm not sure I completely understood the instructions," the funeral-suited man said. "If I might be allowed to..." The being on the right held the mirror up before the funeral-suited man, and the being on the left reached into the funeral-suited man's chest with a deft and aggressive movement, extracted the man's heart, and placed it on the scale. "Oh, dear," said the Christ emissary. A sound of horrific opprobrium and mourning echoed all across that kingdom. The diamond doors flew open. I blinked in disbelief at the transformation within. The tent was no longer of silk, but flesh, speckled and pink with spoiled blood. The feast was not a feast, but rather, on long tables inside, numerous human forms were stretched out in various stages of flaying. The host was no king, no Christ, but a beast, bloody-handed and long-fanged, wearing a sulfur-colored robe, bits of innards speckling it. Visible therein were three women and a bent-backed old man, bearing long ropes of their own intestines. Terrible. But most terrible of all was the way they screeched with joy as my funeral-suited friend was dragged in among them, and the way that poor fellow kept smiling, as if attempting to ingratiate himself with his captors, listing the many charitable things he had done back in Pennsylvania, and the numerous good people who would vouch for him, especially in the vicinity of Wilkes-Barre, if only they might be summoned. Even as he was wrestled over to the flaying table by several escort beings, apparently constituted entirely of fire, such that, when they grabbed him, their searing touch instantaneously burning away his funeral suit, his pain was so great that he could no longer struggle or move at all, except his head turned briefly in my direction, and his eyes, horror-filled, met mine. The diamond doors crashed shut. It was my turn. "How did you live?" asked the being on the right. Seen from this close, he took on the aspect of Mr. Prindle, from my old school, whose thin lips used to purse sadistically as he flogged us precisely. "Tell it truthfully," the other warned, in the voice of my sodden Uncle Jean, always so harsh with me, who had once, drunk, hurled me down the stairs of the granary. As from either side they bumped their heads to mine. I endeavored to let them fully in, to hold nothing back, to hide nothing, to provide as true an accounting of my life as was in my power. They recoiled even more fiercely than before, and the smaller versions of themselves rushed forward with even larger gray stone pots, into which my yellow-footed judges began to vomit spasmodically. I looked at the Christ emissary. His eyes were cast down. "May we confirm?" said the being on the left. From the right came the feces mirror, from the left the scale. "Quick check," the Christ emissary said. I turned and ran. I was not pursued. I do not know why. They could have caught me easily, Of course they could. As I ran, whips of fire flew past my ears, and I understood, from whispers delivered therefrom, the whips to be saying, "Tell no one about this, or it will be worse upon your return." Upon my return, I thought, and a splinter of terror entered my heart and is lodged there still. I ran for days, weeks, months, back up the trail, until one night, stopping to rest, I fell asleep and woke up here. Here again. And grateful, so deeply grateful. I have been here since and have, as instructed, refrained from speaking of any of this to anyone. What would be the point? For any of us here, it is too late for any alteration of course. All is done. We are shades, immaterial. And since that judgment pertains to what we did, or did not do, in that previous material realm, correction is now forever beyond our means. Our work there is finished. We only await payment. I have thought long and hard on what might have caused me to merit that terrible punishment. I do not know. I did not kill, steal, abuse, deceive, was not an adulterer, always tried to be charitable and just, believed in God, and endeavored at all times, to the best of my ability, to live according to His will, and yet was damned. Was it my occasional period of doubt? Was it that I sometimes lusted? Was it my pride when I had resisted my lust? Was it the timidity I showed by not following my lust? Was it that I wasted my life fulfilling outward forms? Did I, in my familial affairs, commit some indiscretion, oversight, or failing that now escapes my memory? Was it my hubris, utter, in believing that I, living there, confined by mind and body, could possibly imagine what was going to occur here? Was it some sin so far beyond my ability to comprehend it that even now I remain unaware of it, ready to commit it again? I do not know. Many times I have been tempted to blurt out the truth to Mr. Bevins and Mr. Volman. "A terrible judgment awaits you," I long to say. "Staying here, you merely delay. You are dead and shall never regain that previous place. At daybreak, when you must return to your bodies, have you not noticed their disgusting states? Do you really believe those hideous wrecks capable of bearing you anywhere ever again? And what is more, I would say, if permitted, you shall not be allowed to linger here forever. None of us shall. We are in rebellion against the will of our Lord, and in time must be broken and go." But, as instructed, I have remained silent. This is perhaps the worst of my torments. I may not tell the truth. I may speak, but never about the essential thing. Bevins and Volman consider me an arrogant, hectoring pedant, a droning old man. They roll their eyes when I offer counsel, but little do they know, my counsel is infused with bitter and excellent experience. And so I cower and stall, hiding here, knowing all the while, most dreadful, that though I remain ignorant of what sin I committed, my ledger stands just as it did on that awful day. I have done nothing to improve it since. For there is nothing to do in this place where no action can matter. Terrible. Most terrible. Is it possible that another person's experience might differ from mine? That he might proceed to some other place and have there some entirely divergent experience? Is it possible, that is, that what I saw was only a figment of my mind, my beliefs, my hopes, my secret fears? No. It was real. As real as the trees now swaying above me, as real as the pale gravel trail below, as real as the fading webbed boy breathing shallowly at my feet, banded down snugly across his chest like a captive of the wild Indian.